Next case on our calendar, 06-1913, A.J. Barkowski Jr. versus Charles Abboud. Mr. Johnson.
Chief Justice, may it please the court. Mr. Barkowski, my name is George Johnson. I represent Judge Charles Abboud. The case before you today is a case of judicial immunity, and the specific question at issue is whether Judge Abboud acted in the absence of all jurisdiction during a 12-day period in the underlying case between the time when Mr. Barkowski filed a petition for removal and the time when the federal court rejected that petition. As this court well knows, the doctrine of judicial immunity is designed to protect the integrity and independence of the judiciary and is not designed specifically to protect individual judges. Judicial immunity protects a judge unless one of two circumstances applies. If the judge is not acting in a judicial role, if he's not performing a judicial function, then he or she is not immune. That is not an issue in this case. It's undisputed that Judge Abboud was acting in an adjudicatory function when these issues arose. The second question is whether the judge was acting either with jurisdiction or in excess of the judge's jurisdiction or in the complete absence of all jurisdiction. If the judge is acting within his jurisdiction or in excess of his jurisdiction, judicial immunity applies. It's only when the judge acts in the complete absence of jurisdiction.
What is your response to that scenario? Was he acting with or in excess of his jurisdiction or absence of it?
I think that he clearly was acting at a minimum in excess of his jurisdiction, and I think there is a sufficient law that says he actually retained jurisdiction. And I'll hit all three of those topics in pretty summary fashion because I know the court is well aware of this facts scenario. It's undisputed in this case, and this is really critical, that at the time Judge Abboud began acting in this case, he had subject matter jurisdiction. So the only question is whether he lost all jurisdiction when the petition for removal was filed. And the Sixth District Court of Appeals confusion on this matter is really not all that difficult to see. The terms absence of jurisdiction and excess of jurisdiction are not self-explanatory. And you actually have to go back and read these cases to see how these terms apply, because jurisdiction in the judicial immunity context does not equate to what trial judges think and appellate court judges think of jurisdiction in an individual case. Starting back in 1872, when the U.S. Supreme Court addressed this in Bradley versus Fisher, the court made clear that it was imperative that the court have initial jurisdiction over the matter. And if the court was usurping jurisdiction, if the court didn't have jurisdiction when he started, there would be no protection. The Supreme Court back in 1872 did us the favor of giving an example. If you have a probate court whose jurisdiction is limited to wills and trusts and estates, and that probate court attempts to hold a criminal trial, there is no jurisdiction from the beginning. That probate court is usurping jurisdiction that it doesn't have, and he acts in the absence of jurisdiction at that point, and he's personally liable. He's not protected by the doctrine. On the other hand, if you have a criminal court judge who does have jurisdiction over a criminal matter, and he finds a defendant guilty of a crime that doesn't exist, or he vastly exceeds his sentencing authority, those acts in sentencing for a crime or finding guilty of a crime that doesn't exist or a preposterous sentence that's not authorized by law are clearly in excess of jurisdiction. The Supreme Court pulled up those same examples, the U.S. Supreme Court in Stump versus Sparkman in 1978. And again, the important words are subject matter jurisdiction, which this court picked up in Wilson versus New in 1984. This court said an excess of jurisdiction as opposed to an absence of jurisdiction means that the act, although within the power of the judge, is not authorized by law. So we have this touchstone of subject matter jurisdiction, which is easier to understand than an absence of jurisdiction or an excess of jurisdiction. Perhaps the most enlightening case that this court has given on this particular subject is the 1939 case of Stahl versus Curry. And in that case, the court said specifically, if on the facts before him, a judge has no competence to deal with the matter at all and nonetheless does so, He does so without jurisdiction. If he starts off with jurisdiction and he ventures too far, he is merely acting in an excess of his jurisdiction. There's a Sixth Circuit case, which I know this court is well aware of, Stern versus Masseau, which was a different set of facts, because what this court had done was disqualify Judge Masseau from acting. And Judge Masseau then went and held a contempt proceeding. And the plaintiff filed a writ of prohibition in this court. This court said clearly that in acting after an affidavit of disqualification had been filed, and after the Chief Justice had sent a letter saying, take no action until this matter is adjudicated, by holding a contempt proceeding in that time period, he acted, said this court, in the absence of jurisdiction. And this court was talking about jurisdiction to act in that particular case. The plaintiff, Mr. Stern, then filed a case personally against Judge Masseau, and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeal said, yes, we know what the Ohio Supreme Court said, but they were talking about jurisdiction in terms of jurisdiction to act in this case. And we are talking about whether Judge Masseau had subject matter jurisdiction over the case when it started, and that subject matter jurisdiction is it's a different analysis for a judicial immunity case. Interestingly, the Sixth Circuit in Stern looked back to an Ohio appellate case, State versus Swiger, which gives perhaps the very best summary. Swiger Court said, subject matter jurisdiction focuses on the court as a forum and on the case as a class of cases and not on a particular case. And that's the helpful analysis. Does the court have jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction of cases of this type? The Fulton County Common Pleas Court, where Judge Abood was sitting as a visiting judge, undisputably had jurisdiction over garnishment actions like the one in which Mr. Burkowski was a defendant. So here, under a careful analysis, it's clear that the judge was acting at most in an excess of jurisdiction. Justice O'Donnell asked the question of whether there was any real jurisdiction. And in fact, there's reason to think that there are. There are three cases from other jurisdictions, and there are only three cases that we've been able to find that deal with this exact fact set, a court who acts after a petition for removal has been filed. They were all federal courts. They're all from different states. They all come to the same conclusion. The judge has subject matter jurisdiction, even though the case has been put into this limbo by the filing of a petition for removal. And two of those three cases harken back to Stump versus Sparkman, and specifically to Stump's quoting of the language from Bradley versus Fisher from the 1800s. So the touchstone is still this subject matter jurisdiction. Those three cases are laid out and described in our brief. U.S. Supreme Court law stands for the proposition that when a notice of or a petition for removal is filed, it merely affects a stay and not a divestiture of jurisdiction. And interestingly, the federal removal statute nowhere uses the word divestiture. And finally, there is both U.S. Supreme Court law and Ohio appellate law that stands for the proposition that where the petition for removal is faulty, actions taken by the trial judge between the time that the petition is filed and the time it's rejected by the federal court are valid actions. So there are two reasons to think that jurisdiction was actually proper when Judge Abood rendered his decisions during the time that the petition for removal was pending. Strong public policy reasons, as always, to defend judicial immunity. It's the reason the entire system works. And this case gives this court an opportunity to perhaps speak with a little more clarity about what an absence of jurisdiction as opposed to an excess of jurisdiction actually means. The cases stack up. This court has said it before. Perhaps if it could be said one more time in a little more straightforward fashion, it could be more easily interpreted by the courts of appeals.
Mr. Johnson, the Court of Appeals seemed to suggest that because there was an allegation that the judge acted with bad faith, that this was a reason to find the assignment of error well taken. Would you comment on that, please?
Yes, the Court of Appeals was assessing this under a separate immunity, not judicial immunity, but statutory immunity for employees of the state of Ohio who are involved in non-automobile cases.
So that was 9.86? Okay.
And it wasn't argued by the judge, and it's not argued in this brief.
But all right, so we don't have to worry about the bad faith issue at all?
No. An allegation of bad faith is not one of the factors that, a court would consider in determining whether judicial immunity applies. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Borkowski, you may approach the podium, and you have 15 minutes to tell us why you believe the Court of Appeals is correct.
Good morning, Chief Justice Moyer and the rest of the court. First, I'd like to ask the court to uphold the law and treat me no different than an attorney.
Could you pull the microphone towards you a little so we can hear you there? That's good.
Is that better? And to uphold my constitutions, not only the state, but also the U.S. Judge Abu, pursuant to 1446, I might have the statute room. Got it right here. Pursuant to the federal statute on a petition of removal, once it's filed in the court, in the federal court, and a copy is served upon all parties, served upon the court is to proceed no further up and until the case is remanded back by the federal court. In this case, Judge Abu received a copy of the notice of removal. He conspired with co-counsel or counsel for the plaintiff. They both decided it didn't affect his jurisdiction. He proceeded.
Well, in all fairness, Mr. Borkowski, that removal wasn't timely filed, was it? You'd admit that.
It wasn't timely filed, but yes, it was. They're pursuant
well,
to 14,
let's see.
46.
It was filed on the day of the trial, wasn't it?
It was filed the day before.
The day before the trial.
Yes. And
all right.
A copy was dropped off at counsel's office on the way back from federal court
right.
The day before.
There have been three decisions, the Antelman, the Hoppins, and the classic distribution case that Mr. Johnson referenced, where other courts have had similar cases to the matter before us, where a matter had been removed to a court, and they've all determined that the court may have acted in excess of jurisdiction, but not in the absence of all of it. And I appreciate you're not counsel, but why shouldn't we join what the other jurisdictions have done and rule similarly in following what the written law is?
Well, the statute 1446B is pretty clear. The state court is to proceed no further. And as far as filing a timely petition, the petition can be filed, I've recently discovered, up to five times, and it can be filed up and after a final judgment. Once been discovered, there's this constitutional issues rise for removal of a case. So it can be filed within 30 days after receiving of a motion, 30 days receiving of a judgment. In this case, it was the district court remanded it back, said it was untimely filed. They didn't consider all the issues at fact. I wasn't up to date on the federal statute to that part, or I would have resubmitted it. And then the Court of Appeals was correct. There was an issue relating the bad faith in 9.86, which Counselor is correct. It does involve motor vehicles, but it also states that any elected official can be held responsible without losing his judicial immunity. And therefore, I seriously request and ask his court to uphold the Court of Appeals and move to Lucas County Court for at least discovery, depositions on relating that bad faith claims, because that has not taken place. I also filed a motion or a written notice of this morning to read additional oral arguments, read argument by reading and or submitting it in paper. Would this court like me to read it, or do they just allow me?
You can do whatever you want with your, you have a little more than 10 minutes remaining.
Okay.
If you want to read parts of it, you may, or if you want to leave it with us.
I'll skip the captions. Now comes the appellee, A.J. Burkowski, move this court for leave, read and or submit to our argument for the October 9th, 2007 oral arguments to the Ohio 14th Amendment due process law and equal protection of the law and Supreme Court practice rule 14, section 4, and memorandum supports attached. The appeal and complaint arose on an eviction proceeding. Appellee was a defendant and over which appellee Judge Boob presided. The evidentiary hearing was held in the matter on May 13th in Fulton County Court of Common Pleas. Just before the start of the hearing, the appellant allowed appellee to file the notice of removal to federal court. The notice had already been filed stamped by the United States District Court of Ohio. At the hearing, plaintiff testified that she was the owner of the property in question. She also provided testimony as terms of potentially of a lease between herself and the appellee, and appellee failure to pay. Appellee, for his part, offered no evidence. Instead, acting pro se, he argued the trial court was devoid of all jurisdiction to consider the eviction complaint with notice of the removal. Notice of the removal was filed. The court found that filing the notice for removal did not remove the court's jurisdiction, then proceeded to hear evidence in the case. At the close of the evidentiary evidence, the trial court found the appellee had been default under the terms of the lease, therefore was subject to an eviction proceedings. The trial court judgment was journalized May 17th, 2004. A writ of execution of judgment was filed on May 21st, 2004. On appeal, the Court of Appeals found that the case was removed to federal court from May 13th to May 24th and remanded the case for further proceedings. The appellant in this case failed to proceed with the Fulton County case as instructed by the Court of Appeals, even after the appellee filed a leave to proceed for him to proceed in the underlying actions. Appellee filed a complaint against the appellant, a judge of the Fulton County Court of Common Pleas, for alleged violations of ORC and the Ohio Constitution, including neglect, acting in bad faith, and acting in clear absence of all jurisdiction in Lucas County Court of Common Pleas. Together with the complaint, appellee filed a notice of independence stating the action involves real property owned by the appellant. Appellant filed a motion to dismiss appellee's meritorious claims and a motion to declare appellee's notice of independence void. The Lucas County Court of Common Pleas found the appellant was entitled to absolute immunity, granted both of the appellant's motions and journal entry filed on December 31st, which one was on the 29th and one was on the 6th of December. Appellee timely appealed the judgment's entries forth in the December 1st, 2005 journal entry. On appeal, the Court of Appeals found that the appellee acted in clear absence of all jurisdiction rather than excess of his jurisdiction, and therefore his judicial immunity lost his judicial immunity in the case. As a result, found the appellee's first assignment error well taken. The Court of Appeals further found the appellee had alleged that the appellant acted in bad faith and that the trial court made no determination with respect to that allegation. As a result, reversed the trial court's decision and remanded the matter to further proceedings consistent with the decision of the September 22, 2006. Appellant made no motion for reconsideration prior to filing his notice of appeal in this action. Appellee is seeking $1 million in damages for the appellant and other relief because appellant acted in clear absence of all jurisdiction rather than excess of his jurisdiction. Therefore, he's lost judicial immunity in the case, and result, he's obligated to pay the $1 million in damages because of his assertion, bad faith, acting in clear absence of all jurisdiction, conspiracy against the appellee. The manner in which justice only frivolous appeal motions, filings appellant has filed against the appellee and appellant should be overruled. The law and argument appellee urges the court plaintiffs in the eviction proceeding was not the owner of the property in question because there was no title to pass pursuant to quiet title actions due to Attorney John Schaefer's involvement or fraudulent misconduct. See Disciplinary Counsel versus Schaefer, 98 Ohio State 3rd, 342, 2003, Ohio 1008. That he did not own the property, that he did not own, owe plaintiff any rent because he was the owner of the, by legal title of property in question. The property in the case not only unlawfully acting in the absence of jurisdiction, but also through the appellee office property in question. The plaintiff in that case has since the eviction proceedings evidentiary hearing disclaimed any interest in the property in question in all cases. See appellee's third motion dismiss at Exhibit 1. Appellee further urges this court that he was the owner of the property in question as set forth in Exhibit B attached to his third motion to dismiss. Appellee's grandmother gave the property to him in question, property in question to him. Last will and testimony already filed stamp Polk County Court of Common Pleas 2000. Appellee further urges this court that he informed appellee and counsel of record for the plaintiff that he was diverged of all jurisdiction to consider the eviction complaint. When notice of removal was filed pursuant to USC 1446. However, at the hearing, the appellant and counsel determined that filing a notice of removal did not remove the court's jurisdiction. Then he proceeded to hear the case, evidence in the case. He was wrong. At the close of the evidence, the appellant improperly found that the appellee defaulted under the terms of the lease and therefore was subject to an eviction proceedings. The appellant's judgment entry was generalized May 17th and writ of execution filed on May 21st. Appellee urges this court that the appellee was diverged of all jurisdiction from the time the notice of removal was filed, May 12th, pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 1446B, until May 24, 2004, when the case was remanded back to the trial court, and that the appellee's entries issued during that time period is potentially void. Further, appellee asserts that the appellant violated Ohio's revised code and the Ohio Constitution, acted in bad faith, clear absence of all jurisdiction, when he proceeded to hear the evidence in the case when he issued entries during the period of May 12th through May 24th, or otherwise violated the appellate's civil rights pursuant to ORC 2921.45. Smits that had the appellant and counsel of record not conspired with each other.
You have 2 minutes remaining, Mr. Borkowski. Pardon? You have 2 minutes remaining.
Okay. And other not had unlawful hearing, he would have been opportunity evidence owner of the property in question. Waived counterclaims would not have been subject to eviction proceedings and would still be residing the property in question due to the appellant's bad faith, including acting in clear absence of all jurisdiction, lost the property in question. Therefore, I'm going to skip down. Federal District Court, based upon 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution, pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 1331 and Article 3 of the United States Constitution, according to Judge Beal, was adequate and proper jurisdiction for the purpose of absolute immunity. Therefore, the appellant acted in clear absence of all jurisdiction. He was not absolute immune for his extrajudicial acts. Appellee further urges the court set forth in his merit brief and incorporate reference to the Court of Appeals correct ruling and reversing trial court's journal entry of December 1st, 2004, and the appellant is not precluded under ORC 9.86 or the United States Constitution because he has in fact acted in bad faith or wantonly, recklessly, and that the trial court made no determination to the respect of certiorari. As a result, this court, like Court of Appeals, reversed the trial court's judgment or otherwise affirm the Court of Appeals' judgment. Decision and remand the entire matter for further proceedings consistent with the Court of Appeals' decision on entry decision, consistent with the Court of Appeals' decision. I'm out of time, so I got to stop.
Thank you, Mr. Bukowski.
I thank you for your time this morning.
Mr. Johnson, you've saved almost 5 minutes of your time.
Chief Justice, the only thing I would add is a citation of authority for the response that I gave to Justice Lanzinger. Clevenger versus Saxner is a U.S. Supreme Court case found at 474 U.S. 193, and specifically at page 200. The court makes clear that the motivations of the judge in taking the actions that the plaintiff complains of aren't material and don't affect his judicial immunity. I thank you for your time. We respectfully request that the Court of Appeals be reversed and the trial court's dismissal of the complaint against Judge Abood be reinstated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.